Hi there, welcome to the Lockdown Show on iTunes, Spotify, wherever you're listening, welcome. This is going to be the audio version of the YouTube original video of the Lockdown Show. I really appreciate you stopping by and checking out this wonderful podcast, which pretty much talks to people from all over the world about different things, from how they're coping with isolation, anxiety, and obviously their personal lives and, you know, what makes them successful, what they've done and what they haven't done, life stories and so on and so forth. So you are listening to an audio version of originally a video that was on YouTube. So if I say links in the descriptions, etc., that's just the full disclaimer. So thanks for stopping by and thanks for checking us out. And I hope you enjoy the show. My very special guest today is Robin Hanson, and hopefully I can fit in as much as possible of the wonderful achievements that he has managed to do over his life. Robin Hanson is Associate Professor of Economics at George Mason University and Research Associate at the Future of Humanity Institute of Oxford University. He has a Doctorate in Social Science from California Institute of Technology, a Master's degree in Physics and Philosophy from the University of Chicago, and he spent 9 years as a research programmer at Lockheed and NASA. As well as that, Professor Hanson has over 4,510 citations. Oxford University Press published his book, The Age of M, Work, Love and Life, When Robots Rule the Earth, in June 2016, and his book, The Elephant in the Brain, Hidden Motives in Everyday Life, which he co-authored with Kevin Simler in January 2018. Professor Hanson has 1,007 media mentions, given 370 invited talks, and his blog, overcomingbias.com, has had 8 million visits. Professor Hanson has pioneered prediction markets, also known as information markets and idea futures, since 1988. He was the first to write in detail about creating and subsidizing markets to gain better estimates on a wide variety of important topics. He was a principal architect of the first internal corporate markets, and, you know, it goes on and on and on. He has a diverse research interests with papers on spatial products competition, health incentive contracts, group insurance, product bans, evolutionary psychology and bioethics of healthcare, vote information incentives, and so much more. He coined the phrase the greater filter to analyze why the universe looks so dead. Now, normally I have guests on for an hour to an hour and a half, but Mr. Hanson, depending on his schedule, I wish I could have him for the rest of my life, because I think I could talk to him about everything. But after much consideration, I decided to focus on evolutionary psychology for this talk, and hopefully he would be so kind as to come back again in the near future to discuss the many other subjects that he's such an expert on. It's an absolute privilege and pleasure to have him on the show. That being said, let's begin today with the Lockdown Show podcast.
Professor Robin Hanson, thank you very much for jumping on the podcast with me.
Great to be here.
So, Robin, for people that don't know where you are, please tell us where you are in the world right now and how the coronavirus pandemic and the lockdown has affected your life.
I'm in Northern Virginia near Washington, D.C. I'm a professor of economics, so my semester's just ended. I have had a lot of contact with people online doing interviews like this and teaching my classes, but that's just ended. And I've allowed myself to be distracted a fair bit in the last few months thinking about pandemic-related issues, but I see diminishing returns to that and hope to sort of get onto a bigger book projects working at home.
Mm. Okay. And in your state, are there quite strict lockdown rules where you are?
There are lockdown rules. I don't know how strictly they are enforced, but I've mostly been staying home. Our state, Virginia, has had some release of lockdown, except near where I am, because apparently cases are higher than me.
Okay. And, you know, there's so many subjects we could talk about. We're going to stick to evolutionary psychology on this particular show. But What is your views on this pandemic and the virus itself?
Well, basically, it looks like this will just go most everywhere. That is, initially, public health officials saw that this had escaped farther than any pandemic in the past that had ever been contained. And they assumed, well, I guess we can't contain this anymore. We will have to mitigate it. But then elites around the world said, no, that couldn't be. We must try harder to contain. And so that containment became the official policy. But it still doesn't look like that's going to be feasible. And the effort to try to contain is very expensive. And I fear we're going to do more damage in trying to contain it and then still failing and still getting, as many people infected. And so I've been focused on a plan B for what happens if most people get infected. And I've been focused on the concepts of deliberate infection, where you can control who gets infected where, when, and how, and variolation, i.e. ways that you can deliberately infect with low dose, better strain, different delivery vectors that can have much lower death rates. And so we could plausibly cut death rates from this disease by a factor of 3 to 30, if only we would do some simple trials to verify that a low dose, in fact, gives a lower death rate for this disease.
But do you think that's? I mean, I want to hear about your plan B. Sorry to interrupt you.
My plan B, in part, is to deliberately infect people, controlled okay. infections. That is, have a hero hotel where people go there. They sign, they pay for it, and then they go in the door, and then they are deliberately infected with a low dose through a safer delivery vector. And then they have to stay there until they are recovered, so they don't spread it elsewhere. So that's much more efficient use of isolation resources and also of medical resources, and it can let them get back to work and socializing sooner instead of waiting around forever. So it has a number of great advantages, but unfortunately you have to sort of admit that we're in a plan B world in order to want to pursue this, admit that we are not actually going to contain this, and it's going to go everywhere, and we better be ready for that.
What about people who are vulnerable? So like myself, I'm an asthmatic.
Yes.
Well.
So, but as the more vulnerable you are, the more that you want to be infected in a way that will reduce the harm that you get from being infected. I get that the more you're afraid of this disease, the more you definitely would want to contain it if you could. But the question is, what if you can't contain it? What if it's too late and too expensive? And what do we do then? So if you get accidentally infected, then you face the risks we've seen so far and don't fully understand of what it is. If we could deliberately infect you, we might get a much weaker reaction, a much less severe symptoms. So the worse it is, if you get accidentally infected, the better it would be for you to get a lower dose and better outcomes by being deliberately infected.
Is it possible that people are like asymptomatic as well? Like they could have had it and they had no idea that they were carriers?
Oh, sure. I mean, certainly many people are asymptomatic initially when they have disease, and it's possible that many people are asymptomatic entirely through the course, particularly young and healthy people. But that doesn't affect the wisdom of deliberate infection if, in fact, most people are eventually going to get it.
Mm. Okay. And so is this herd immunity you're talking about, but like a controlled form of herd immunity?
Well, in the scenario where most everybody's going to get it, the thing that stops it is that eventually so many people have it that it can't spread as far. That's what herd immunity means. So in the plan B scenario, there is no alternative to herd immunity. There is nothing else. The question is just how you reach that point, not whether to reach that point.
Okay. And like, the UK and the US have got the highest death tolls in the world. Is that because of dense population or is that poor planning? How do you interpret the way these countries in the West have managed this pandemic?
Well, first of all, there's the question of like where it spread and when. And then there's the question of like who is how densely populated. So it gets to dense areas first. So, the United States was definitely a place that traveled a lot, where a lot of people travel to, and so is the United Kingdom. So all else equal, you would have expected them to get things first, along the list of countries. And they have a lot of sort of big dense cities, and you expect those to have more problems. But in addition to those factors, it does look like the U.S. in particular has just managed this badly, especially in our early test stage. And so there's a very interesting, deep, difficult question of understanding the range of responses around the world and the range of success. Now, high death rates will, of course, in some sense, come from like high initial exposure. So, you know, the end of the game is after most everyone gets infected, and that's when we really want to keep score in how many people died then. So if some places get it earlier, they will, of course, have earlier deaths, but that doesn't mean they will eventually have more deaths. It depends on, you know, how they handle it as it comes through.
And the majority of people, like myself, I've only just heard your plan B and I find it fascinating and very interesting, are waiting, especially if they're more vulnerable or high risk, are waiting for antibody and vaccine, antibody tests or a vaccine. And we keep hearing different information thrown about by the mainstream media that it might be years away, months away, we don't know. Based on your expertise, let's start with an antibody test first. How far away are we from that being mass manufactured?
I don't know about tests in particular, but I do know that basically a lot of people have been saying we need to scale up testing, but then we've been failing to do that as fast as they want. And you know, that means it's really quite an ambitious thing to imagine massively scaling up testing. We can scale it up modestly, but when you have lots and lots of cases, then you need far more tests if you were going to use tests to contain it. And so it still looks like testing is not enough to contain this.
Okay.
It's not going to work. We just don't have the numbers.
And a vaccine, the magic cure?
Vaccine is just years away. I mean, basically, the only people ever telling you that vaccine might be soon are the companies that are trying to get press and attention for their vaccine trial.
I see.
You talk to the other people, they all tell you this, look, we're talking years away and, you know, there may never be a vaccine. We have many viruses for which we've never had a vaccine.
Yeah. So is this, are we taking this too seriously as a human race? Because obviously this is a worldwide thing now. It's not just a state or a country or whatever. Everybody's dealing with this pandemic in different ways. You know, people are saying it's not as serious as the flu or, God forbid, cancer or anything. Where do you stand on that?
There is always a risk of overreaction. So, for example, 9/11 was a disaster in the United States, 3,000 people, you know, killed in a day. And then we overreacted and did even more damage as a result of our overreaction. So just because something bad is happening or has happened doesn't mean you should do everything that occurs to you in response. That can be too much. And so I think for this disease, we are at risk of that. We're invoking the norms of, you know, no man left behind and never risk, you know, never tolerate any risk of health harms. And, you know, that can be very expensive.
Why weren't we prepared, as Bill Gates drummed down our throats in a TED talk or whatever it was a couple of years ago? Why were we not prepared for something like this?
I think at some level, the West has to see this whole crisis as indicating that we have poor governance. Okay. And these are deep governance problems. So, you know, the places that have done best are places that have, you know, a bit more centralized government, but also just a lot more change over the last few decades and that they've been adapting to, including a lot more pandemic-like conditions. And so they've had situations like this recently and that they prepared for and reacted to. And so they've learned from that. And they've been just dealing with a lot of big change and they aren't encrusted with all the layers of regulation and veto powers and all that that our world, our system has. So basically we have to kind of take this as message. Look, you've been letting your system atrophy, you know, get weak, get brittle. And look, this is telling you that your systems are not working very well. And there's no easy answer for that. It doesn't mean there's like a single fix that will suddenly do it all. It means you have to go back to basics and say, you know, how do these systems work? And what are the sort of things that could go wrong with them such that you would end up with bad governance? And of course, we have large literatures on these sorts of things. But usually when times are good and peace and prosperity, we say, it can't be that bad. Look, we're doing okay. Now, when you have a problem, you have to say, no, maybe we aren't doing okay. Like, maybe we need to look at this stuff.
what do you, we're going to move on to our main topic in just a second, but, you know, survival of the fittest, you know, only the strong can survive. What do you think about these people who have no underlying issues, fit as a fiddle, are healthy? Yes, there might be a small percentage who are getting this virus and becoming critically ill and, God forbid, dying from it. How does that make sense in, you know, in terms of what we're being told, oh, it only affects the elderly and everything, when people who have no issues at all are dying, and it's aggressive and it's contagious and it's just tearing their bodies apart?
Well, I mean, it's clear that, you know, the strongest predictor of harm from this disease is being old and sick in many ways. I mean, that's a very strong correlation, but of course it's a correlation isn't always exactly rule. Even some young people will have bad outcomes, but overwhelmingly that's the correlation. They have far lower rate of such things. So, you know, should those young and healthy people be locked down, the trade-off there seems much worse, right? Because the chance of harm is much lower, and but they're still paying the same social and economic costs for lockdown. At some point, you have to make a trade-off for the cost versus the benefit. You know, we all take risks all the time, of course, in our lives. We drive and fly and, you know, eat fish dinners where a bone could get stuck in our throat. And, you know, it's any time, every auto accident is grim and sad, but still, does that mean you want to not drive?
Or fly? Some people are afraid of flying as well. Yeah. last question on this. Are we on the verge of a revolution? Are things going to change or not? Are things going to stay the same?
That's where it's up in the air. So after many of our past crises, we told a story. We agreed on a story of what was the problem and who were the heroes and who were the villains. And everyone's eager in every new crisis to set that story, to set themselves as the heroes and their rivals as the villains. And when you look back, it seems almost inevitable. Of course, that would be the story. But you realize when you're in the midst of it and looking forward, you really can't tell. Mm-hmm. You don't know who will win this battle for the story of COVID to decide who are the heroes and the villains. And once we decide that, then of course, that may be the rationale or justification for big changes if the, you know, people who are seen as the heroes push for new changes to, you know, reduce the influence of the rivals that they blamed for it, etc. But it's an option, but it's not inevitable. I mean, we could well just go back to our usual ways of doing things after a crisis like this. I mean, in fact, for most previous crises, that's what we usually do. We, you know, shove it off and explain it at something and go back to what we usually did. And, you know, unfortunately, that maybe we don't learn from this that we had serious governance problems. We just keep doing what we're doing and we have to wait for a bigger crisis to teach us that lesson.
Well, they say history does repeat itself. And speaking of history, let's get into this topic, which I'm really interested in learning about, because I said to you off air, treat me like a lab rat, an ape that doesn't really know anything. He's learning how to speak for the first time when it comes to this subject, because I have a fair understanding of some strands of psychology, but evolutionary psychology, I haven't got a clue. So let's begin. What is evolutionary psychology?
So psychology is, you know, thinking about how your mind works and the habits of your mind, you know, thoughts and words and behaviors that we explain from your mind. So minds are big and complicated. So of course, psychology is big and complicated. It's got lots and lots of parts that do things different ways. But it's a healthy field with a lot of progress. When you're trying to explain the mind, you're looking for a framework of explanation. That is, how would you predict what a mind would be like or do? You have to have some way of making such predictions. So evolutionary psychology is the framework for thinking about minds, which says, well, these minds came from somewhere. There was a long process in which they were developed and honed. And the more we can understand about that process, the more we could use it to make predictions about what sort of minds we expect to see and what sort of behavior we expect them to have. Now, that's not the only framework from which you could think about minds. We have many different frameworks. Like, for example, you say, well, minds have a lot of computational constraints. It's a difficult problem to take all this input and to calculate things and produce outputs. So just that difficulty by itself is a constraining factor that you can use to help understand what minds do. and that we do certainly do have some success from that. Each of these perspectives from which we think about minds, in principle, complement each other. That is, they don't have to be in conflict. You know, evolution could have formed minds, but it also formed them with respect to the computational constraints that are there. And so both of those help you understand what's going on. So that's the broadest perspective, is just to say evolutionary psychology is just about using what we think we know about where minds came from to predict what they're inclined to do and how.
Okay. And so when you say evolutionary psychology, are we learning from our ancestors or from animals or from different times? What exactly are we drawing upon?
You know, in general, you're just opportunistically trying to draw on anything you can to figure out anything you can. I mean, we were just, you know, really, when you don't understand things very well, you're going to grasp at whatever you got.
Okay.
So one source will be to say, well, look, there's a whole world of animals out there. Animals have minds. And what do we know about animal minds? What do we know about the patterns of which kind of minds are where and what features they have? And then we say, well, humans are another animal. So how can we situate humans relative to all the other animal minds and draw by analogy from the animal minds to humans? You know, that's certainly one source. Mm-hmm. When we're thinking about different animal minds, we ask about the contexts that they evolved in. We ask, are they in a desert? Are they under the sea? Do they live long lives? Or they live in big groups? And all of those things seem to affect animal minds. And so when we look at humans, when we're trying to ask, well, which animal mind should we expect humans to be most like? We ask, well, what sort of environment did humans evolve in? Where did humans come from? And so that's the heuristic of looking for and trying to understand and imagine the origin of human environment, the ancestral environment in which our ancestors evolved, as a way to predict the kind of mind that would have evolved there, and then therefore the kinds of minds we have and the kinds of things we're inclined to do.
So where did humans come from, Robin?
Well, you know, the standard story, which I would guess is roughly right, is that there's a lineage of other primates, and we are descended from a primate lineage. And so we look farther back and we see the, you know, proverbial monkey and then the proverbial primates. And we see things like gorillas and chimpanzees, and orangutans. And we say, well, you know, that's part of where we came from. And so one strategy is to look at the mental features of those animals. What features do they have in common? What varieties do they have? And that's certainly one of our sources. And then if we look a little farther forward in time, a little less back from where we are, we say, okay, out of that set of primates, where did humans show up? What was their initial environment? And how did that differ from other primates? And apparently our understanding is they showed up in Africa first, and they therefore lived in that sort of climate in Africa, and they apparently lived in larger groups than other primates do, and that's important for predicting what their minds were like. And they foraged, that is, they moved from place to place instead of staying in one spot all the time. Another set of data we have is to look backward in time from us at the most distant ancestors we can find that we've ever sort of met and talked to. So, you know, today we all are industrious living in big cities, but, you know, as you know, a few hundred years ago, there was no industry to speak of. Most people were subsistence farmers. And 10,000 years ago, it seems that there was a transition from what's called a forager to farming, whereas people started to farm roughly 10,000 years ago, but before that, they didn't farm. So you want to ask, well, what were people doing before they were farming? They were foraging. Well, what does that mean? How do you find those people? Well, you know, there was a slow transition of displacing the foragers with farmers. And even a few hundred years ago in our world, there were still foragers left in the margins of our world. And people went out and talked to them and looked at them. And so people have written down this description of what foragers were like in many parts of the world, you know, before we pushed them all away. And even today, there are still a few isolated people out there still living the forager lifestyle. So that's one other big clue to what our ancestors were like, is to see what these most ancient cultures of humans are like in the last few hundred years when we've gone out and met them. And, you know, then now you have to sort of interpolate in your mind between the, you know, the creatures we know of post-primates, that is, you know, what, where they lived and what kind of groups they had and things like that. And then the most ancient recent historical people we've met in terms of how their life, and that's where we tend to form our picture of the ancestral environment that humans evolved in. Foragers who lived in larger groups than other primates, but still much smaller groups than we live in today, who didn't stay in one place, who wandered from place to place, and then who spread across an amazing range of environments across the world, which meant they were relatively flexible in general. They weren't very tied to very particular environments, and they had a capacity to adapt to a wide range of environments, from deserts, hot deserts, to the Arctic Circle. And sort of that's also a key data point we have about humans, is this capacity to survive and adapt to a very wide range of environments.
That's so interesting. Let me get my little pen out so I can have a little timeline here. So we're thinking, so I want to go from primate to farmer to, you know, current day. So what sort of time frame, if I was going to draw a timeline here, which I'm going to write out as I'm speaking to you now, what sort of timeline are we looking at here? Go for it. Yeah,
so if you want to say, when did the human line diverge from, say, chimpanzees or something? Last I remember is like 6 million years ago. So and that would be our closest, you know, ancestor within the primate world. So you're talking 6 million years ago there. Mm-hmm. And if you're talking about when do some sort of distinctive creatures who seem to have a lot in common with us appear, maybe you're talking 1 million or 2 million years ago.
Okay.
And then they evolve and change over time, but they still seem to be our ancestors. And then, you know, you don't have farming until 10,000 years ago.
Okay.
And then farming slowly displaced foraging, although you have precursors to farming like maybe 50,000 years ago. So we have sort of some data out there about paintings and sculptures and things like that to give us some weak clues to the kind of minds our ancestors had around that period. Mm-hmm. And we know that one of the sort of apparently driving factors and differences was density.
Okay.
That is, as they lived closer to each other in larger groups, their behavior changed in important ways, and their ability to change behavior is important, changed in important ways. And so, you know, the places where farming first showed up were the places where they were had the highest density before farming. Mm-hmm. And even, like, apparently, surprisingly, the first large concentrations of people mm-hmm. existed before the first farmers. That is, you know, cities or towns existed before farming. That is, farming is apparently a response to cities and towns. As long as you're all hanging out together periodically, you might as well put more work into the food that you generate around you. And that's where farming started.
So when our ancestors evolved from the primate, were they all, was this happening across the planet, or was this in like dense areas where, like, for example, like you said, in different environments around the world, were they like closely congregated together and then they were evolving from them in one area, or was this happening all over and then they spread? How did that happen?
Well, most of the data that we have that's best comes from Africa. That doesn't mean we're not missing data from elsewhere, but it makes it seem like Africa was the strongest concentration of activity. Now, basically the way evolution works is, you know, mutations show up everywhere and then they spread when they're successful. But if there's a network, then the center of the network is where you should expect on average to see the newest mutations appear. Mm-hmm. Right, because if a mutation appears at the edge of the network, then it takes a lot longer to spread everywhere, and it's going to go through the middle before it gets to most other places. Okay. And so Africa's kind of the middle of the network.
Okay.
That is, okay. You know, it's this big, it's really huge, and it's got a huge area for, you know, creatures to exist, and other areas are more in the periphery. So, you know, when innovations show up on the periphery, they spread to the middle and then they spread elsewhere. And so that's why you should just generally expect to see sort of advancement in the middle of the network first.
Okay.
And so that's okay. why basically you do see first new things show up first in Africa.
Okay. How reliable is this data?
Well, it depends on which data you have in mind. So, what would you like?
Well, just even just this theory of like we've 6 million years ago primate, 1.2 million years ago ancestors, which I would assume are like the Neanderthal. Is that what you're referring to?
Neanderthal is actually much more recent. I
mean, that's 100,000
to 50,000 years ago.
Okay. Yeah. So that lineage, basically, Robin. Like, how reliable?
So there's different kinds of evidence, and so the basic evidence is pretty reliable, but what conclusions you draw from it get weaker the farther away you get from the evidence itself. So, the 6 million year timescale that comes from DNA evidence. So for example, we can look at our DNA, we can look at chimp DNA, we can see how rapidly it changes, and we can extrapolate back to say, well, when did it probably diverge? So that's sensitive to sort of estimation of these mutation rates, which might be off by maybe a factor of two. But then you have a number of different, you see fossils of these things and you can see how the rate at which they've changed. So, the fact that our DNA is definitely closest to chimps of any other animal, and it differs by a certain amount, and that amount predicts a time, and that time is the 6 million years.
Okay. Not, are we 98% identical to chimps DNA wise, or is that, have I got that wrong?
I've heard a figure thrown around that, but I'm not sure how exactly you want to do that sort of measurement. Basically, look, pretty much all living organisms share a lot of DNA because we all share, some basic how our cells work and things like that.
Okay.
So what you really want to be thinking about is sort of the differences that matter, or the differences that are.
Okay. Really,
we do have a lot in common, an awful lot.
Well, that's my next question. What do we have in common with primates? I know that might be obvious to some, but what do we have in common with them?
Well, the easiest way to see that is just say to maybe watch a video of them doing stuff. they live in small groups. They, of course, first of all, we have in common with primates what we have in common with most all animals, which is a lot, right? We're born and we die. We need food. We need shelter. We can be hurt. We fight. We need senses to look around us. We have, arms and legs to do things. So if you just go down a long list like that, we have a lot in common with other animals. Clearly, we are an animal, right?
Mm-hmm.
Our flesh is made out of the same sort of fleshy material, mm-hmm. right? I mean, just go down the list.
Mm-hmm.
Now you say, well, in addition, what do we have in common with primates? Well, you might say, we're similar sized creatures, for example. We have a similar degree of, behavioral flexibility. That is, like a bumblebees do wonderful things, but they don't adapt very well to new environments or situations. they have this, basically hard-coded set of behaviors that work well for them, but are stuck. Whereas we and other primates, we are much more adaptable. That is, we play and explore, we try different things. We, take little ventures out where we go and explore a new area and see what it's like and maybe come back if we don't like it. We look at new kinds of food and wonder if we could eat that. we just are clever in that sense, and thoughtful and complicated in our minds. And that's correlated, of course, with the fact that we have big brains, which makes sense then to have, because the animals in the world that have the more complicated, subtle behavior like this tend to have big brains.
Mm.
And, and we are also very social, which makes sense that we are, our complexity of our brains is in part tied to our social world. That is, we think a lot about the people around us and how they're behaving and how to interpret that and how they will see us. Mm-hmm. And that's true of primates in general, and certainly true of us, and less true of most other animals.
I'm so glad you said that, because I'm promise you, I'm steering into psychology, evolution psychology. I'm just asking a lot of evolutionary questions because I'm kind of educating myself along the same way. So here's a really stupid question, probably. Why are there still primates if we evolved from them?
Well, the world has many ecological niches. This is like a key point. So imagine there was just an ocean and all the ocean was the same everywhere. And so there was a competition to say that be the animal that floated near the surface that got the sunlight. So in that sort of scenario, what you expect is the one best organism wins and it's the only thing you see. Mm-hmm. So then you might expect to say, well, what if there's a predator? They might distinguish that there's a predator who eats this thing from this, you know, plankton that just sits there and grabs sunlight. And so now we've got two species. The plankton that just tries to grab sunlight and evade the predators, and now the predator that eats the plankton. But then if there's different competitors, or different predators, we might expect they would compete with each other, but only one wins out. Mm-hmm. So the fewer environments there are, the fewer species there should be, because there's only a limited number of niches. You could be the plankton, you could be the predator, and maybe you could be the predator's predator. But there wouldn't be that many slots to be in. And then you might be the plankton that's near the surface of the ocean, and maybe there'd be a different kind of thing to be 100 meters down where you don't have much light. And maybe that needs a different design, right? So you see, the key idea is the more different environments there are, the more different slots there are for a creature to be, then the more different kinds of creatures there would be. Mm. And so remarkably, our world has this enormous range of environments. And that's in part because it's on land. That is, in the ocean, there are in fact fewer kinds of environments. And so in some sense, there are fewer species. Mm. It was having life go on land that really opened up a huge range of environments to have a huge range of species. Mm-hmm. So there's, you know, there's mountains and there's rivers and there's valleys and there's deserts, there's swamps. Mm. And, you know, then there's hills that go up and down. And, you know, there's just all this enormous variety. And then as soon as there's a large variety of animals and plants, then that variety itself creates new niches for other ones. So if you're a predator, then being a predator all depends on what kinds of things are around for you to prey on. Mm. And when there's different kinds of things around, then you need to be a different kind of predator.
Mm. Mm. Wow. That's the way. Is there another obvious example of like a species that evolved like human from primate that you can think of that are coexisting in the world right now?
I'm not sure what you mean by species of human from primate. I mean, sorry. Humans are, sorry, in a sense, primates. So there are, yeah, many, sorry, kinds of primates in the world.
An example like that. So like this, like, I don't know, like, let's say if dinosaurs still exist, like birds and dinosaurs coexisting in the world, like, but they're the same species, so to speak. I don't know. It's a bit of a stupid question, but
literally birds are dinosaurs.
Okay.
Birds are the creatures that evolved from dinosaurs. Okay. In our world, they are the dinosaurs.
Okay.
But of course, there's a huge range of birds in different environments. And so, I mean, this radiation by which like species just diverge and split and change for different environments is just the rule all through the biological world. That's just generally what happens. So having many kinds of primates who split and specialize in different areas, that's, of course, the usual rule. Mm-hmm. The weird or unusual thing about humans is how enormously successful we've been. You know, any one species isn't usually that successful.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, maybe a typical species of primate might have, you know, 10,000 copies. There might, mm-hmm, be 10,000 of that kind of primate out there.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and the minimum might be 100. If you go much below 100, maybe the species just dies. There's not enough of them to last.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But, you know, when farming revolution started, we had 10 million of us around the world, and now we've got 7 billion.
Mm.
So clearly something unusual happened there. Mm. That enormous growth. Oh, now we are so large and influential that we are having a substantial fraction on the entire rest of the biosphere.
Mm.
So there's something really big that happened eventually that is different from all the other primates, obviously. Mm. And of course, the question is when those differences showed up and what were they?
Mm. Last few questions on evolution. When we think evolution, obviously the most famous name to put to it for Joe Public like myself is Charles Darwin. Was there any studies significant towards evolution
pre-Darwin that you know about that were that have never really been brought to the forefront for somebody like me to read up about or educate myself on?
So, the basic fact of intellectual innovation is that usually the person who's famous for something wasn't the first person to do that sort of thing. That's just the general rule. That's also true for Darwin. So, before Darwin, there were definitely many other people who talked similarly about the idea that animals evolved and changed and that there would be pressures on them to change in various ways. But what often happens is we say, you're sure those were precursors, but they didn't have exactly the right package that we celebrate today of all these, of the right set of ideas. And so for Darwin, you might say, well, he had a clearer idea of this idea of natural selection, that the driving force was just, random variation, and some of them survived more than others. And there are even other people who even spoke to that. Even say Wallace is a contemporary of Darwin's. So Darwin was basically doing his work in private, sort of. He was very worried about religious and other sort of cultural reaction to his ideas. And so he wasn't in a rush to go public. He spent decades trying to collect his information and to be ready to go public. And then what happened is some other scholar, Wallace, basically had been working on the ideas and was about to go public and said, he went to the Royal Society in England and said, I'd like to give my paper on this topic. I want to talk to people about my ideas about natural selection. And then the people in the society who happened to know of Darwin went to Darwin and say, hey, someone is going to scoop you. And so they arranged it for both of them to present at the same time. And so that's, in some sense, kind of not fair to Wallace. He was the one who was willing to go public and say something. But Darwin had the right connections so that he could appeared to crow up at the same time. And of course, his way of doing it was considered more rigorous or acceptable by the community. And so he got more famous than Wallace.
Was there, I mean, I don't know how to ask this question. Did he ever touch on evolutionary psychology, or was he more just on the basics of
Oh,
natural
so
selection?
definitely Darwin had a whole book on thinking about the mind and emotions and things like that. And he definitely thought about, wow, where the human mind came from and how we could understand some of its features in evolutionary terms.
Okay. And I heard a rumor that he was a religious man, and most scientists are. And obviously, that goes contrary to the theory of evolution. I mean, I'm a religious man myself, but I'm trying to be impartial and have an open mind. Nothing you say is offending me. I'm just, trying to educate myself here. But is there a way that you can have both theories to coexist, or what's the basic? I mean, what's your argument for the
Well,
religious
certainly
whole?
the remarkable fact about religions and religious people is they can apparently encompass a very wide range of attitudes and stances toward all these things. There is no like one official way to be religious. So as you know, even many Christians have had this enormous range of interpretation flexibility of, say, looking even at the Bible and asking how literal should we take what they said there versus how metaphorical. And so, Darwin had that same range of flexibility available to him. So, he apparently found it sufficiently compatible to do both, or he encompassed a contradiction. Look, a lot of us actually just hold contradictory beliefs. That's just a common human thing. So, that therefore it could also be true of Darwin. He just held contradictory beliefs. That's what we do sometimes. When we have things that we're too attached to and we notice later on that they're in conflict, then we find a way to like live with it. So I don't know in detail, Darwin's attitude to religion and the kind of religious stance he has, but I certainly know that many people in the world through history and even today find varying degrees of compatibility with evolution and religion.
What drew you to this subject in particular? I mean, you're drawn to so many subjects, Professor Robin, but what drew you to this subject in particular of evolutionary psychology?
Well, I am more of a theorist by habit and intellectual style. And so I'm looking at the world, looking at patterns, wondering, can we explain them? Can we understand them? And as an economist, I was used to the framework where we say, look, people have a limited number of fundamental goals, but then they're in a lot of complicated worlds. And so the same limited number of goals are applied to these different worlds, and that explains our complicated behavior. So we say, you know, when you're driving, that's different than you're biking or when you're cooking. But we can say, well, look, the context of driving or the context of cooking can help you understand why you do different things when you're driving or cooking. But your fundamental goals are relatively abstract and understandable, and they're driving this. So that's how economists reason, for the most part, is to take a relatively limited, you know, description of what people want and what their constraints are, and then apply that to just the vast range of different situations people get in order to understand why they behave differently in different situations. Mm-hmm. Evolutionary psychology is a similar sort of intellectual framework. Evolutionary psychology says, well, species have a limited number of things they need to do, and they can show up in a wide range of, you know, ecological environments and situations that any one animal might be in. But fundamentally, we can try to understand all the different things animals do and all the different ways they are from this very limited set of goals that they would be trying to achieve. Mm-hmm. And so it has that same structure as economics does. A limited set of purposes and a limited set of, you know, resource constraints, and then a wide range of situations that that gets applied to that explains all the different behavior. So, and of course, when you're trying to understand economics, you're often tempted to use psychological explanations, at which point you wonder, well, where do these psychological explanations come from? And that would then also tempt you to think about evolutionary psychology. So most psychology is not as theory-based as evolutionary psychology. That is, most psychology is looking nearer to the surface of your mind and using that to explain things. So for example, you might say, well, he behaved that way because he was mad. Okay. But that's not the end of the story. We could say, well, why was he mad? Then we could go, well, he's mad because yesterday this other thing happened to him. Okay, go back to that. And we say, well, why did this other thing happen to them yesterday? And then often we might eventually go back, well, he was brought up and was trained initially in life in the following way. You know, he went to these schools and grew up in this culture, and that's why he thought it was appropriate to be mad when the following thing happens to him. And so you can see these explanations aren't necessarily contradictory, but they're at different levels of indirection. There's proximate causes, i.e., you know, if you murdered someone, what was going through your head at the time, and what was your habits of action? And then there's more distal explanations, things that happened farther back in time that caused this. Well, evolutionary psychology is going as far back as you can. It's saying, what are the fundamental pressures that would create, that would make evolution produce a creature like you, such that you would then later on be in an environment and do a thing like this? So that sort of distal explanation going back to foundations appeals to me, because that's what I do in economics and I'm more of a theorist.
Mm. And we're going to get into your theories hopefully in a second. So with psychology, it's more, well, human psychology is more about circumstance, you're saying, and people's upbringing and stuff like that, whereas environment is more, well, the environment plays a bigger part with evolutionary psychology. Is that correct?
Well, it's just going farther back in the causal chain.
Okay.
So again, in psychology, sometimes you might just say, you know, you might say this person, you explain what they're doing because they're distracted, for example. So if you're trying to do something without distractions, often what you do is different than if you're distracted. And so we do lots of psychology experiments where we have people do something and then we distract them and we see how they do things differently. And often they, you know, we can learn interesting things about how their behavior changes when they're distracted. But distraction is a very proximate cause, right?
Mm-hmm.
Right? It's right there next to the thing that's happening. There's lots of interesting things to learn by studying proximate causes, but there's also interesting things to learn by going back deeper, like mm-hmm. how you were brought up or the culture that you're in, that's the sort of thing sociologists and might do, for example, or anthropologists. And then there's evolutionary psychologists, which is just going back even farther to say, what kind of creature are you and where did that kind of creature come from?
Mm. So, please, I've watched a few of your talks and the hidden motives in animals and humans, laughter similarities and stuff. I'd love to hear some of your theories and ask you questions about them. So please share with me the ones that you think are most beneficial for people to discover, really.
Okay, so when we're thinking about our own behavior, the people around us, one of the key explanatory variables is motives. We ask, what was someone trying to do? And not only do we do things, we have reasons for doing things. And we tell a set of standard stories about what we do and why. Now, of course, all animals do things and all animals have a reason for doing things, but most animals aren't able to explain or describe why they do particular things. So one of the unique features of humans is that we have language and we reason somewhat abstractly, and so we can talk about why we do things and explain to others why we did something and why we didn't do something else. And so that's a common feature of your environment, that you explain yourself to people, you explain yourself to yourself, you look for explanations of other people asking, why did they do this? What was their motive? So motives are just really central to human behavior. So one key thing to tell you is you are wrong about your motives a lot more than you realize. That is, the story you're telling yourself about why you do things is not correct. It is a misleading and incorrect explanation of what you're doing. It might have some partial relation, but it's missing a lot. Mm-hmm. So that should be surprising to you, of course. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You're probably pretty confident about your explanations, naturally. So why are you wrong? I have to sort of explain to you where that could come from. So to help you understand why you're wrong, we have to say, well, what is talking for? And what is this conscious mind you have that thinks about your motives? What's it for? What's it doing exactly? So the key thing to realize is your ancestors evolved in a very social environment. That is, they were in large groups, much larger than other primates. And groups were so large that they could be relatively safe when in the group. And so the major environment that mattered to them was the rest of the group. They needed to stay on good terms with the group. For example, if the group kicked you out and you were no longer in a group, you were much more vulnerable. You were not going to have a good life. So you wanted to stay in a group and stay on good terms with the group. And of course, in the group, if people liked you more and respected you more, then you might get better protection. You might get better mates. You know, all sorts of good things would come to you when you're in a group that likes you. So our ancestors evolved to be social in the sense of putting a lot of priority and attention on, you know, being on good terms in the group and winning, say, the political competitions and other social competitions to be respected and influential in the group. That's where you come from. Now, by itself, none of that tells you that you'd be wrong about your motives. So from that, we have to say, well, how did groups keep the peace? So many different primates are in smaller groups than we are. And the key thing to notice is that it's harder to manage larger groups. So what we see is that as groups get larger, they have more internal conflicts and there becomes harder to keep the group together. It tends to split and fragment through internal divisions. So, you know, as you know, if there's N people, then there's N times N minus one connections between them, over two connections between them. And so the number of connections goes as a square of the size of the group. And that's part of why it's hard to manage a big group. So humans found a way to manage much larger groups than other primates. And so a key question is, how did humans do that? Mm-hmm. And a key story is that the way humans were able to manage a larger group than other primates had was through norms, rules. So in a chimpanzee group, say, there is a dominant chimpanzee or a dominant group of chimpanzees, and they lord it over the other ones and they get big advantages. And they each sort of submit to the bigger group if they need to, but rebel if they think they can get away with it. And there's a lot of behaviors and patterns, but they don't have rules in the way we do. That is, a rule is, if you see someone violating the rule, you're supposed to tell other people, hey, they're violating the rule, and then coordinate with those other people to say, what are we going to do about this person violating the rule? That's what a rule is for humans. And that's not what other primates have. They don't have rules or norms. So how is it that humans can manage to have rules and norms? Well, there's two things we have the other primates don't. First is language. I can see you breaking your rule and then later on tell someone else somewhere else that you broke the rule. Whereas if without language, I'd have to point and I have to grab your shoulder and point over there and have you see the other person breaking the rule. And of course, language is needed to express the rules, what you're allowed to do, what you're not allowed to do. Mm. And we also have weapons. So if say the dominant chimpanzee is breaking a rule, what are you going to do? You know, they're the big one. And so how are you going to make them stop breaking the rule? But in human groups, we have weapons so that a large group of us can enforce a rule on anyone. In a chimpanzee group, if say there's a top chimpanzee and you sneak up in the middle of the night and punch him, that doesn't end the fight. You know, you got the first punch in, but you will still lose if you're not as strong as the big chimpanzee. But for humans, we really can kill someone in their sleep. And we can stand from a distance, you know, 10 of us all throwing rocks and hurt one person who's bigger than us. Mm-hmm. So these weapons allow the group to enforce its rule. So now sort of the majority opinion matters a lot more. If a whole group all says you broke the rule and you need to, you know, give in to us or we'll punish you, if even if you're the biggest guy in the group, you still will lose that fight mm. because of weapons. Mm. Mm. So now humans have weapons and rules to allow us to keep the peace. Mm-hmm. We say you can't murder people, you can't steal, you know, you shouldn't even like act like you run the group. Mm-hmm. We all have to discuss things together. So humans made a bunch of rules that allowed them to keep the peace in larger groups. Well, of course, an important rule was share your food. You come in from the hunt with some nice tasty meat. Well, you don't take it all for yourself. You share it with the rest of the group. So humans evolved in these large groups. We're really focused on, you know, being liked by our group and social. And we have these rules, and that's sort of the main thing that keeps the peace. So we all are really interested in seeming to follow the rules. It's really a bad thing if the rest of them agree that we broke the rules and we're not listening. And we also, of course, are eager to find our rivals and to accuse them of breaking rules. That's a really important part of our lives. Mm-hmm. You know, we were in these big groups. The groups are what matter. And the main thing that keeps the peace are the rules. So we really need to make sure we're following the rules and look for opportunities to accuse our rivals of breaking them. Mm-hmm. So that's the situation in which I say you're wrong about your motives.
Mm-hmm. Okay. How long are we talking here, Professor? Are we talking in the 1 million to 2 million year group when you're referring to our ancestors or nearer than that?
Yes, sometime between 2 million years ago and 100,000 years ago.
That's incredible. Wow.
This sort of thing is going on.
Wow.
We're evolving into larger groups. We develop language. Wow. And we develop rules that go with language, and we develop weapons. So we can see weapons farther back in the historical record. We can see weapons go back 1 million years.
Wow.
Okay. It's harder to see language in the record.
Okay.
But we see sort of the bigger brains, and we see the larger groups. We see those parts of it. And we know that, of course, recently people are really into rules. Mm. That's a really central part of our social world even today.
So how would leaders, you know, we see this in films and stuff all the time, the alpha male, you know, the alpha of the group and everything, the leader of the pack. How were leaders decided and rules even decided 1 or 2 million years ago?
Even to ask about leaders means you're not getting what they were like.
Okay.
So a wolf pack may have a leader, a farming group through the last 10,000 years, most groups there had leaders. Foragers did not have explicit leaders. They were fiercely egalitarian.
Okay.
It was against the rules for you to act like you thought you were the leader and that people would follow you. That was against the rules.
Oh my God.
So we were all supposed to be on the surface treated as equals. That was a key part of being a forager. And that's what we've seen from forager groups in the last few hundred years when we found them in the margins of our world. Oh, wow. So you share your food equally. You know, when there's a discussion, you contribute equally. You don't give the impression that you are threatening people or giving orders or that you think you're better than other people. That was a strong norm, and they enforced that norm strong, you know, vigorously. So, of course, they did have leaders. They just had to pretend otherwise. So, and that's the key point to think about. Foragers did a lot of things in hidden ways when they pretended otherwise. Mm. And you are evolved from those sorts of creatures. So there were prestige rankings, And some people were respected more than others, but you weren't supposed to acknowledge or accept that. So for example, some people were better hunters than others. Mm-hmm. Some people went out and they brought more food back. Now, if they just brought the food back more often with more bigger food, then everybody would know they're the better hunter. And then they would kind of feel like they were a big shot, and maybe they thought they could decide who got the food and things like that. So often foragers had a norm, say when they used bow and arrows, they would each have an arrow, but then they'd go out and switch the arrows. And then whosoever arrow hit the animal was the one that got to distribute the meat, but it wasn't necessarily the person who shot the animal whose arrow it was, you see, because they switched the arrows. And this was an important part of pretending that nobody knew who the better hunter was. Of course they knew. They gossiped. They knew. But they pretended they didn't know. Somebody like, they had to make all decisions in a big group meeting. They all sat around the campfire and talked about, is it time, you know, to go somewhere else and leave this campsite? Or, for example, this person broke the rule. What should we do about it? So when they all got together having a discussion, the norm was everybody could say their have their say. Everybody's opinion was treated seriously and equally in some sense. But of course, we all know that there's some people more respected. So what do those more respected people do? And you've probably seen it in committee meetings in your world today. The high status respected people will sit back and say less initially and wait for the conversation to go a certain direction. And then at some point they will say, well, what I'm hearing now from you is, and produce their summary of the situation. And then everybody can say nod and say, yes, that's right. That's what we've agreed together on. But what they're really doing is deferring to this leader. But even today, leaders try to lead not by directly giving orders, but by seeming to reflect the consensus of the group.
This is so interesting. So was it harmonious, even though they were preaching equality towards each other and trying to get along, or was it quite...
It was harmonious enough that they could function in larger groups and they didn't split up. That's the key metric, right? Other primate groups, when they got larger, they split up because the acrimony and the conflict was just too much. Mm-hmm. So humans did manage to keep the conflict down to a level that allowed the group to stay. But that doesn't mean it was always peaceful. Mm-hmm. So for example, you know, some of the most common violence was over mating. They were not mate for life people. They tended to pair up for a few years, which might produce a child, but then they had a lot of extramarital sex, a lot of premarital sex, and a lot of changing partners over years. And that produced, of course, enormous amounts of jealousy and acrimony. Mm. And a lot of the, you know, death and violence you would see in these groups was jealousy produced. And of course, sometimes they're breaking rules and doing these things. And so one thing after, so the key thing to understand about forager group is they have these rules, and the rules are keeping the peace, but they are not consistently exactly enforcing the rules. They are sort of enforcing the rules, but some people get better treatment than others from the rules. So to give a concrete example, one rule is you don't hit someone first, right? If they hit you, maybe you can hit them back as a way of defending yourself, but you're not supposed to start a fight, right? So we have similar norms like that, right? So how do you hit someone that you want to hit when they haven't hit you first? Well, you claim they hit you with sorcery. So the existence of sorcery is this claim that they were giving you the evil eye or doing something that made bad things happen to you, your stomach ache or whatever it was, and now
bad,
you're entitled to hit
juju.
Them back.
Bad juju.
Exactly. So you can see how flexibly interpreting the rules lets them kind of evade the rules.
Amazing.
But now they will need the support of the group to in their interpretation of the rules, right? If the group says, no, he didn't hit you with sorcery, then it's not going to work for you to hit him first. So there's a lot of politics in terms of what you really need to do is get everybody on your side, but you phrase it in terms of the rules, and they broke the rules and you didn't.
Carry on, I've interrupted you there. So sorry.
Just the key point is to connect it back to motives.
Yeah.
So a lot of norms are expressed in terms of motives. This is the key point.
Yeah.
If I hit you accidentally and say I'm sorry, that's okay. If I hit you on purpose, that's not okay. So a lot of the rules are connected to motives. There are banned motives connected with actions that might be derived from those motives. That's why you care a lot about what other people think about your motives. If you're trying to present this image that I don't break the rules, then you need to have a good story about all the things you've been doing and what your motives there were. Mm-hmm. So that you can say, I did not intend to hurt them at all. If I did, it was accidental, and I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. I was intending to do this other thing. Mm. Right? Mm-hmm. Sure, I said they were a bad hunter, but that's only because we needed to make a decision about where to go hunting, and I decided if they're a bad hunter, then that was not going to help. But I didn't mean to insult them and hurt their feelings. No, no, no. I was just trying to help with this group decision.
So when were they, so what I was going to ask you, when were they able to differentiate intention and accidents, or, you know, actually process that? Were they able to do that?
Well, before language, we differentiate intention, for example.
Okay.
So for example, you know, even animals have property rights about prey. So one predator chasing a prey, another predator might come along and say, I think I'll take that prey. You've already worn them down a bit and you're already pretty worn down, so I could jump in and like finish it off and then it'll be mine. That's considered not fair play among predators. Of course, different species will do it anyway to each other. But like within a group of, say, wolves or something, they have these norms that if I'm chasing it and I've worn it down, then it's mine. Mm. Right? And mm-hmm. so if you come along and seem to be chasing it, then I will mm-hmm. be mad at you. That you're trying to steal my thing, but maybe you could say, well, oh, I didn't realize you were there. Sorry about that.
That's funny.
About motives.
Oh God. It's hilarious. It's so good.
You know, I slept with her. Yeah. But I thought you two were broken up. If I had thought you guys were still together, of course I wouldn't have done that.
And to think
that
conversation is stretching back 1 to 2 million years ago is just, oh my goodness, it's amazing. Professor Hansen, when did the alpha male come into the picture and like alphas and leaders?
Well, the alpha male was there before humans, and then again after, once farming showed up, it was just on the surface absent during the forager era. So as you know, even say gorillas, there's an alpha gorilla, usually in a gorilla pack, mm-hmm. and it's usually mm-hmm. like the one male and lots of females. Mm-hmm. And then even in chimpanzees, there's the alpha chimpanzee, or usually the team of alphas who are buddies who are the coalition that dominates. Mm-hmm. And of course, during our farming world, and even today, there are dominant players and partners, but it was during the forager era that was forbidden. And that's where your intuitions that's unfair come from. So if you look around you, you notice people are often really primed to be suspicious of leaders and to really have a chip on their shoulder about some people having more than others and some people being thought better than others and some people thinking that they are allowed to give orders. And so our whole resentment of kings and tyrants, our love of democracy, our always bosses always being the bad guys in movies, and the worker, poor undertrod worker being the good guy, that's from our forager ancestry.
Hmm. How did the alphas suppress their anger and resentment and the disrespect shown towards them for, I don't know how many years that happened for?
They had to pretend to not be the alphas again. And of course, many humans are quite good at this today. They had to act on the surface like they're just one of the guys. Jesus. And they're just like expressing their opinion like everybody else is, and they're not asking for any favors. But, you know, behind the scenes, we all kind of know that we're all looking to them and we're going to follow their lead. Mm. And so even today, you know, bosses in most workplaces today do not give direct orders very often. Mm. And of course, movies have satirized this. The Office Space movie, for example, if you've ever seen, mm-hmm. has this boss come around and say, you know, it would be good if... Sure would be nice if.
I love it. We're going to touch on movies and television in a second. When did personalities start developing, like, you know, different traits of personality?
Well, well before humans. I mean, the same sort of personality types that differentiate humans apparently also differentiate chimpanzees.
Oh, wow. Oh, my goodness.
So they have the same sort of range of different, you know, the shy and the extroverted and all that sort of stuff.
Wow. So even our ancestors had that below the surface, even though everybody was kind of in it together.
They didn't need language to express it. So, you know, chimpanzees express a lot to each other. They're around each other a lot. They're reading each other a lot. They definitely have sense of how each other's feeling and what they're up to. And they deceive each other. Like, for example, if I found some nice little berries and I'm eating them, yum, and then I see somebody coming along and I don't want to share it with you, well, then I like hide the berries. I pretend I'm doing something else until you're gone, and then I go back to the berries.
That's brilliant. That's amazing. And it's interesting that you said about resentment, because obviously from a biblical point of view, we've got the story of Cain and Abel, which essentially Cain and Abel were the first, you know, resentful, you know, beings in the Bible as such. And then it spewed into jealousy, the him murdering his brother, then war. The first weapon was developed by Judo-Cain or something, like his son or something, I can't remember. So when did serious conflict kind of a war come into play in our lineage?
So there was a long transition from foraging to farming, but farming initially was very violent and a lot of conflict. So and foragers are very averse to that. So it was a long and painful transition to turn people from foragers into farming. And we can talk about how that even happened, how people even have the cultural plasticity to become farmers when they're foragers. So foragers, again, are very egalitarian. Foragers don't have much property. So they don't really have property and land. They move from place to place. They don't really have much things because they have to carry them. So their physical objects that they own are really small in number, not that valuable. And they don't even own wives or husbands because they're relatively promiscuous and they switch partners a lot. So they don't have much to fight over in terms of groups fighting each other. So forager groups, in fact, they want to stay on good terms with each other because typically, you know, young girls, when they come of age, they switch to another group so that they leave the home group, go to another group. Mm-hmm. And so you want to stay on good terms so that they'll send you their girls when they come of age. And that's why these groups didn't fight each other and they didn't really have conflict. And even within the groups, there wasn't much property to fight over. So they didn't do much fighting. And in addition, they just weren't near each other enough. So density, again, is this huge key parameter. Mm-hmm. Foragers are low density. That is, they're wandering around. They may meet another group a couple of times a year. And other than that, they never meet any other group. It's just a group of, say, 20 to 50 people who are wandering together. Mm-hmm. But the more and more there are of them, the closer they get to each other. And then eventually they stop moving and stay in one place. And that's a key distinction of farming. Mm-hmm. You have enough food density around you that you don't have to wander to the next place when you run out of food here. Mm-hmm. So that density enables a number of key things. It enables trade, which is really important. And you can't find them. You don't have anything to trade. There's not much point in trading. Mm-hmm. So when there's high density and you stay in one spot and then you accumulate stuff because you can keep it around because it's in one spot, then you have more stuff to trade. Mm-hmm. There's more others around you that you can find in a predictable place and trade with. And so trade enormously increased once people were close enough to each other and stayed in one spot. Mm-hmm. But the same thing that allows trade also allows war. Mm-hmm. That is, you can find them. They're in a place and they stay there. So that place is valuable. And they've got stuff that you can grab. And that stuff is valuable, including wives. So farmers also now have stable long-term marriages. And that means that the romantic partners are also property you could grab. So now there's a lot more reason to go to war. Mm-hmm. They've got land you want. They've got wives you want. They've got stuff you want. And then they're nearby. You can find them. Mm-hmm. And now you've still got the weapons. And now you can use the weapons for war. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And now you have hierarchy. So now you're densely enough related that people stay in one spot and they accumulate more stuff. And so some of them accumulate more stuff than other people do. Mm-hmm. And now they can create dynastic hierarchy, you know, dynasties where they pass on things to their children. Mm. And so class distinctions show up at that point. Mm. And even slavery. You can win a war and take them as slaves. Mm. And domestication of animals, of course, treated similarly as human slaves. And that's an important part of your property and things you can go grab. Mm-hmm. And of course, horses let you travel long distances to fight wars, et cetera. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So the farming revolution pretty much changed the game, really. You're saying from foraging to farming is
so when... enormously, you have to wonder, yeah, how could they be the same animal?
Yes, yes, yes.
You saw,
yes,
animals out there making that big a change, you'd be flabbergasted. You go, but you know, we used to see them doing this, and now they're living an entirely different life.
Mm.
And that's just not something we ever see animals do.
Mm.
And so that's a key distinguishing feature of humans. We were flexible and general enough that when a new niche opened up where there's a new kind of behavior that would be profitable, we figured out how to change not only our personal behaviors, but our culture and our norms and our values so that that became possible. And a standard story is that religion was one of the elements that made that more feasible.
Mm.
So well, we say, where did religion come from and what's it for? Yeah. One of the things is it allowed that sort of change to be smoother and easier.
Mm. Well, if they're so influential, why don't farmers rule the world? And that's a stupid question.
They did. Farmers did rule the world until the Industrial Revolution. And so then now we have to ask, well, how did another huge change change? And so in some sense, the three biggest things that ever happened to humans were, first, the introduction of humans relative to other primates in terms of having the weapons and language, and then the large groups and norms. And then farming is the second big thing that happened, this enormous change we've just been talking about. And the third big change that's ever happened was industry. And that just happened a few hundred years ago. Mm-hmm. And to a first approximation, those are the only three things you need to understand about what's happened to humans to get most of the picture of what humans are like now.
Yeah. You've this taken me an hour, but I think I get it. I think I get it. I think I'm getting it now. What's the next revolution? Robots? Technology? What's the next?
So I have a book, as you may know, called The Age of M, Work, Love, and Life When Robots Rule the Earth. And so, yes, robots are plausibly the next revolution. So if you look at these last three revolutions, there is key distinguishing features of them. Mm-hmm. So basically, there are these eras where growth was steady. That is, the number of humans and their abilities doubled at a constant rate. And then there were these three transitions, which were not steady. And each of these transitions was a transition to a much faster growth rate. So animal brains, say, doubled roughly every 30 million years. Humans, their numbers doubled roughly every 250,000 years, 250,000 years.
Mm-hmm.
Farmers doubled roughly every 1,000 years.
Mm-hmm.
And during the industrial era, our economy has doubled roughly every 15 years.
Mm-hmm.
So the obvious prediction about the next one is that it will grow even faster, say doubling every month.
Okay. Okay.
That would be one prediction about the next era. And we know a number of other things about these previous eras that we can use to make predictions. We can say, well, each of these transitions was less than a previous doubling time,
mm-hmm,
and often substantially less.
Mm-hmm.
So that tells you that this next transition would probably be less than 15 years.
Oh my God.
In a 5-year period, perhaps, you'd have a transition from the world we're familiar with to this new robot world that doubles every month. That's another pattern you can follow here.
Mm.
In addition, in each of these areas, there was a cycle that lasted roughly a third of the doubling time. Mm-hmm. So during the forager era, basically, there was a standard cycle of the environment that was roughly on a 100,000-year timescale, where the ice ages came and then went back and came and back. And that was an important cycle during the foraging world.
Mm-hmm.
During the farmer world, there was the rise and fall of empires that happened on a roughly 300-year timescale.
Mm-hmm.
And in our era, there is the business cycle, which happens roughly on a 6-year timescale, mm-hmm, the economy going up and down.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So now you'd predict that if the new economy doubles every month, then it will have some sort of cycle on a scale of roughly a week.
God, it's terrifying.
And another pattern to notice is that the group size has roughly gone the square each time. So before humans, ordinary smaller primate groups might be a size of, say, 6.
Mm-hmm.
Now, square of 6 up to, say, 30, mm-hmm, 5 or 6, forager groups in a size 30 on average.
Mm-hmm.
We square that, we get up to 1,000, and that's the typical size of a farming village in the outlying areas that interact,
mm-hmm,
with. We square 1,000 and we get 1,000,000, and that's the size of typical large city areas and the population surrounding a city. So we follow that pattern and we square it and we get 1,000,000,000,000. And we'll say the new robot concentrations will be in concentrations of 1,000,000,000,000 robots.
Oh my God.
So this is all just following patterns. And of course, you have to wonder, you know, how reliable the patterns are, but at least they give you some idea of what to think about looking for.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's interesting. And obviously just want to say praise our robot overlords if this video lasts by the time that that happens. So
well, you could be one of them, listeners. Okay. So my book is about robots who are derived from humans. That is, it's about brain emulations where you take a real particular human, you scan their brain and find spatial and chemical detail, and then you make a computer model of that brain using models of how each of the cells work. Mm-hmm. And that model, when you turn it on, initially remembers being the human. You have to convince it it's no longer the human. It would behave the same way the human would in the same situation, and it only diverges because it has different situations. Mm-hmm. And that is a brain emulation. And so my book is about what if that kind of robot takes over the world? Mm-hmm. And so that could be you or your children or grandchildren. They could be the ones who become the emulations and then take over the world. Mm.
Goodness me, it's terrifying. But I need to read your book, so I'm gonna definitely read it.
But you should realize that people in the farming era were rightly terrified about the prospect of the coming of industry, and the foragers were rightly terrified about the prospect of farming. From a forager's point of view, the farming world looks like hell. Mm. Like they got war all the time, and they've got domination and slavery and classes above each other. And they can't go wandering, and they don't have as much variety of food and skills and practices. Foragers worked a lot fewer hours a day than farmers did. Mm. Foragers had more intellectually challenging tasks. Mm. A lot of farming tasks were really boring.
Mm. Yeah, I'm sure they still are, probably, even with industry.
Problems with famines and running out of, you know, limited food because, you know, they had fewer kinds of food they drew on.
Mm-hmm. Oh, my God. It's absolutely amazing. I'm going to actually have to only ask a couple of more questions, even though, like we said, we could speak for hours. If you had to pick one misconception that really grinds your gears when you watch a film or TV when it comes to evolutionary psychology, what is something that you keep seeing over and over again and you just roll your eyes and think, oh, my God, this is completely wrong or false? Is there something that sticks out to you?
Well, I mean, I almost never see anybody on a movie or TV talking about evolutionary psychology.
Okay, well, like
honestly, it just is nothing I ever see.
A concept or a strand about it that they refer to it like we evolved from apes or something like you've seen that.
So, I mean, the most common thing is to say, look, we know so little about our evolutionary past that there's just no point in even thinking about where things evolved from. Therefore, just put it out of your mind.
Okay.
They say, look, we do know some other things about how people think, and that's often tied with just a reluctance to be cynical. So a lot of evolutionary psychology explanations tend to be somewhat cynical in that they have us pursuing what we often consider to be low motives. Mm-hmm. And so a striking fact about humans today is we try to attribute a lot of our behavior to high motives that are kind of implausibly high. Mm-hmm. We are lovers of art, lovers of literature. We want to understand the cosmos, and we want to help all of humanity for all time. And we just want to tell the truth. And you go, but that's not how an animal would evolve. How would that help animals achieve its usual things? And so whenever we look at behavior today and we attribute it to somebody wanting a mate and wanting food and wanting status, we tend to call that a cynical explanation of behavior. And a lot of people are very resistant to cynical explanations. They think only bad people would attribute behavior to that because only bad people, could see inside themselves that they are interested in status and mates. But we better people don't care so much about such things. And that's why such thoughts don't occur to us.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And, you know, of course, that's part of one of the big clues that we're not being honest about our motives is that most of the motives we most like to call attention to are just not very plausible motives for animals to have.
you've really blown my mind this last this talk. It's just
so I should mention I have this book, The Elephant in the Brain: Hidden Motives in Everyday Life, co-authored mm-hmm. with Kevin Zindler, where we go through in great detail explaining why you would have hidden motives, then going through 10 big areas of life saying how in each area of life you're wrong about your motives, including things like politics and religion and medicine and conversation and laughter, and saying that you're just wrong about your motives in all these different areas, and therefore you don't know why you do a lot of things. And I should warn you, it's not necessarily in your interest to know.
Okay.
Your mind was built and designed apparently to not let you see these things. And it makes sense that it would be designed not let you see those things, because that puts you at a disadvantage. Mm. Remember, you're trying to pretend to have these high motives that make you look good. Mm-hmm. The more you realize that those aren't your real motives, the harder it will be for you to pretend.
Mm. That's amazing. Absolutely amazing. I'm going to ask you a very naive question, so please forgive me if it comes across quite foolish. When we look back on evolutionary psychology, how is there like a time frame for as far back as you can go? Now, I'm not saying millions of years. I'm saying, like, does it have to be 10,000 years? Could it be 1,000 years? Could it be 10 years? Like, how far back can you look back? Well,
so the key question is, how rapidly can evolution change us?
Yes. Yes.
So we know that over a period of a million years, there was enormous changes.
Mm-hmm.
Although we also know that, you know, even a million years ago, we shared enormous amounts with most animals. So We know that, like, whatever was the difference between humans and other primates really can't have been that much.
Mm-hmm.
It can have been a modest amount of things, but we will still have shared most of the major designs for major systems in our mind, in our bodies, and even our brains. So we know that, say, the basic structure of primate brains is pretty similar to our structure. So we know whatever were the key changes, they were relatively minor, but important. And then as we look more closely, we say, look, evolutionary rates of change are limited. Therefore, look, we can't have changed very much in the last 100 years. That's just not possible.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And we might say the last 10,000 years. Well, in 10,000 years, a few things can have changed a lot, but not that many things. Mm-hmm. So, for example, we have evolved over the last 10,000 years an ability to drink milk. So, as you may know, there are many people in the world who are lactose intolerant, i.e. they can't drink milk or eat milk products. They can't digest it. Mm-hmm. Once we domesticated animals and were able to create milk cheaply, that became a wonderful food source when we could digest it. Mm-hmm. And so there was strong evolutionary pressures to figure out how to digest milk. And that was a thing that happened over the last 10,000 years. And there's been a couple of other things we've identified as things that have clearly changed over the last 10,000 years, mm-hmm. but mostly not that much. Mm-hmm. Interestingly, one of them is that our brains have gotten smaller. So, which fits with the farming world just being less intellectually challenging.
Mm, mm.
As our world became simpler and easier to manage, we didn't need quite such big brains, and slowly our brains have been shrinking since the transition to farming.
Mm. So technically we would have been more intelligent if we remained foragers, like constantly exploring and stuff, rather than...
Yes, although we also didn't know as much because we couldn't share things culturally. So we might have a smaller brain now, but we are part of this network that tells us a lot more things that foragers would never have anybody to tell them.
Mm-hmm.
So you may know more now, but you're just, even if you're not as smart.
Mm. So is routine quite, mundane routine quite detrimental to our brain evolution?
Well, it shrinks it. Of course, that's the appropriate thing for the brain to do in that context. Mm-hmm. So it depends on what standard you're invoking.
Well, in terms of modern day now, like, you know, getting up, going to work, to jobs that, you know, we don't really like and everything, are we shrinking our brains even further by being heavily reliant on technology?
As we prepare for the robot revolution.
The main thing that's
happened in the last few hundred years is that we got rich. So there were these strong cultural pressures that turned foragers into farmers. Mm-hmm. And those pressures were often mediated by poverty. That is, they were threatened with starvation if they didn't act in the way farmers were supposed to act. Mm-hmm. But as we've gotten rich, those pressures have waned. And so the main thing that's happened in the last few hundred years in terms of our psychology is we've retreated back to our forager roots, at least outside of work.
Mm-hmm.
We realized, gee, you know what? I would like work that was more interesting.
Mm-hmm.
In the farming world, you realize if I don't do the uninteresting work I've got in front of me, I will starve, then you are motivated to do it. But today we say, well, I'm rich enough that I could do lots of things. What's the more interesting thing I would find? And so we are becoming more forager-like. We're also being more forager-like in promiscuity. So farmers were pushed to be monogamous because of pressures like if you have a child out of wedlock, you and the child may starve, and that was a credible threat. Today we realize, okay, if I have a child out of wedlock, that might be okay because I've seen people around me do that and they turn out okay. So these threats are just less weak.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why we've been drifting back to more forager styles over the last few centuries. Mm-hmm. And that includes some trends in religion. We have become less farmer religion-like mm-hmm. and move more towards sort of a forager spirituality style of religion.
Interesting. Interesting. I love it. I love it. It's so fascinating. Well, Professor Hansen, could you please be so kind to remind everybody where they can find you and read your books as well, please?
I am Robin Hansen, R-O-B-I-N-H-A-N-S-O-N. You can Google that and find many things. I have a website full of papers and links at hansen.gmu.edu. GMU is my school. I'm on Twitter, and you can find lots of YouTube videos and presumably this one soon.
Okay. And just sorry, the name of your books as well, please. Sorry, I interrupted
you. So my first book, singly authored, was The Age of M, Work, Love, and Life, When Robots Rule the Earth. And my second book, co-authored with Kevin Simler, was The Elephant in the Brain, Hidden Motives in Everyday Life. Sorry, I'm losing my voice.
That's okay. No, we've spoken quite a long time, so I can imagine that. And all of these links will be available in the description below of this video. Professor Hansen, to round everything off, I always ask everybody to offer a pearl of wisdom to those who have stuck with us throughout this journey on iTunes, Spotify, YouTube, wherever they're listening. And
a pearl of wisdom is,
yes,
if please. If you have intellectual inclinations, but say have to do a job that's not that intellectual, realize that we are rich and we are long-lived. If you just spend some fraction of your free time, your leisure time, pursuing some intellectual project, over long years of life, you can achieve a lot. You, as long as you focus and get into it enough to get good at it and do something that other people aren't doing.
Brilliant. Brilliant. Thank you, Professor Hansen. Thank you.
Nice to meet you.
Well, that's the end of today's show. I really hope you enjoyed it. Thank you so much for sticking with us throughout this very long conversation. And if you liked what you heard and you're listening to this on iTunes, Spotify, wherever, check out our YouTube channel, which is SCG Show. And also check out our website, scgshow.com. The full episode of this podcast is on our YouTube channel under the name The Lockdown Show. There's a playlist directly on our channel. You can't miss it, with all the links the channels and social media and websites of the guests that have featured on the podcast. I'd like to thank you once again for sticking with us and listening to the show. God bless, stay safe, and I hope you have a great day.